Fuck pain, fuck heartbreak, I'm still in love with life.
From the multicultural headquarters of the future capital of the free-thinking states of America known as Los Angeles, this is the Drunken Taoist Podcast. Tonight, it's time for our summertime interviews. First up, a gentleman who's both sociology professor and an incredibly talented martial arts instructor. So good, he is the head coach for our own beloved Savannah M. Justin Hamilton is with us. We will learn all about his new modern martial arts and fitness facility, where he's implementing several innovations to martial arts instructions that makes it much more student-friendly. Here we go! And now, asking you all to spread the words that corporations are not persons, I'm Rich Evers. And my partner in crime, the savage philosopher and middle finger of the gods, Daniele Bolelli. As we invite you to lower the lights, batten down the hatches, and prepare to open your mind, for the Drunken Taoist Podcast begins now. Welcome back, everybody, to another fine episode of the Drunken Taoist Podcast, episode 159. Summer has struck this side of the earth, and so we're going to get into some interviews we've cut over the past few months to get us to when Bolelli returns from Italy and we get back together and get the regular show going. So we'll start right into the fine folks that help us get this all happening and keep us on the air, and that would be our friends on it. Oh, and NIT.com. I know Bolelli, he loves his instant alpha brain. Peach flavored, I believe, is when he digs. But they have so many other things. And as always, we ask you, go check out what they have available. I mean, the thing I really dig, and they even have like a new program to sort of like, it's like the Jane Fonda of exercise videos. But this is for their cool steel mace. You know, it's not just pumping a barbell anymore. It's like swinging like you're cutting wood or a golf swing or so many things that get your arms and legs moving. I love the steel mace. It comes in 7, 10, 15, 20, and 25 pound increments. They do recommend that if you're just sort of learning the motions, it's best to start down at the 10 or 15 range. You can build up as you get better at it, but you don't want to clunk yourself in your head with this thing because it is a bit heavy and quite awesome. So steel maces. And sadly, my new favorite thing is the steel bells. They're pretty much like a medicine ball meets a frisbee. And they come in 10, 20, 30, and 40. I can't even imagine what you do with the 40-pound one. But even the 10-pound one, it's fun to kind of sling around. It takes a little bit to catch it. It is frisbee-esque for sure, but you can also, you know, work in different ways to keep your arms pumping. The website is extensive. There are all kinds of things to check out. We always invite you to go have a look. Discount code in our episode notes at drunkentaoist.com. Grasslandbeef.com. Let me tell you, just yesterday, 4 New York strips, grilled, tasty, tender, delicious, demolished. I made it with my fresh from my garden, I will brag. Sunset squash, patty pan it's also called, yellow and delicious, and then zucchini from the garden as well, onions, garlic, steak on the side. I do believe there were kielbasas as well. Let me tell you, grasslandbeef.com, it is great grass-fed beef, but not just beef. You can also get everything from lamb to bison, pork. They even have duck and seafood frozen and delivered to your house and ready to be delicious. So please check out our friends at grasslandbeef.com. Well, who could be next? Well, of course, it's Sure Design T-shirts. SureDesignT-shirt.com. Right now, they've got 36 T-shirt designs for the fellas. Everything from dragons to crazy sun moon designs in all colors and sizes and shapes. But what they really have that's interesting right now are tank or tunic dresses for your lady so she can keep cool while looking very hot. I would definitely check those out, fellas. You can't go wrong. They're like $18. So they're really the same light weight material that's the t-shirts, but summertime, man. Something groovy you heard to wear. They're the fine folks that actually put our t-shirts together, which are available. We've got the first logo. We've got the Dionysian Parade. We've got the Ikiru enjoying his lady friend's company. And, of course, my favorite, Surfing Nietzsche. Might be running short on some sizes, but they're always available, so to check that out on our website as well. Finally, Snow Roast Coffee. Our friends in Colorado, snowroast.com. They make small batches of coffee as they like to say, roasted, cooled, bagged, and shipped. Stuff doesn't hang around for long, so if you see something on the website, you better grab it then, because first come, first serve, you snooze, you lose. But the stuff is delicious. 1 pound bags, finely roasted from all over the world. There's amazing exotic places where you really want your coffee to be from. Check it out at snowroast.com. Discount code TAO18. Sounds like that might be from last year, but that's what it is. And then a final shout out to our friends at Never Tap Gear. They have Savannah's awesome rash guard, but they also have, for folks that are elderly like Bilelli, knee braces to keep those knees in place when you're rolling. And we always appreciate that. So, hey, there you are. That's a whole big list. I hope you will check them all out. And now, time for the interview. Here we go.
So, ladies and gentlemen, here today, Mr. Justin Hamilton. Justin, welcome to The Drunken Taoist.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have a rather interesting story in more ways than one, but let's start with a simple one, I guess. Or, sure, let's say it's simple, why not? How we originally met, which is entirely through Savannah. So I guess it starts with how you met Savannah while I was having a taco in the probably three booths down, because I was with my daughter having lunch, and it turns out you guys were having lunch in the same place.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah, she didn't tell me where you guys were going to be, and we picked the same restaurant or something. So we were eating in the same when you guys had your meeting the first time.
I never knew that.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. But so that ties to your academic research, everything, but let's jump into it. How did you run into Savannah originally?
So, I was conducting some research for my dissertation in sociology, which I'm doing on women's mixed martial arts athletes.
Oh, typical, right? What everybody does,
exactly.
Right?
Everyone in my department, they're all working on the same stuff. And so I was recruiting research participants, and so the way I went about it is I went on Tapology's website, which is, you know, a huge database for professional mixed martial arts athletes, and I basically contacted everyone in my area, basically everyone in Southern California, some people in Las Vegas, and one of the people was Savannah, and so, you know, she quickly responded back and said she'd actually be available for an interview, and you know, but I had never heard of her at the time. And then, you know, we got together and we did a really awesome interview. And then what I had done with many of the research participants is to thank them for the interview, I offered to do a private lesson with them. And Savannah was actually the only person that took me up on that offer.
Serious?
Uh-huh.
That is so weird.
Yeah. And so so we did one lesson, and then I think she had asked to do a second lesson. And at some point, she had texted me and said, you know, my boyfriend would like to meet you. Would you like to come over to our house for lunch? And I was just talking with my wife about this the other day, and I was saying, you know, in hindsight, I'm just so thankful that I ended up coming over, because, I have a pretty busy schedule, and then I'm also, in certain settings around certain people, I'm actually quite social, but mm-hmm. in other settings, I'm just not that social.
Really?
Yeah, I think just being in social environments, it just takes a lot of energy mm-hmm. out of me. I think I do it well enough, but it does take a lot of energy. And truth be told, most of the time, you know, my favorite place to be is just kind of on the couch with my wife, just, you know, either watching
right.
really bad movies or really bad MMA.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, I really think 9 times out of 10, I would have found an excuse not to come over.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so I was just thinking about this the other day, and I'm like, man, whatever, you know, compelled me to come over that day, I'm really glad it did. And especially because I had no idea who you were at the time. And so I was like, okay, like all I knew is, you know, she said that you were an academic. And so I was like, okay, well, this would be cool. I'll go over there. We'll talk about some research, you know, And you know, and I'm sure, you know, selfishly, you know, I probably saw it as a networking opportunity too. It never hurts to meet more people in academia. And so it was the morning of the day that I was supposed to come over that I Googled you looking for a CV or something. And to my surprise, an actual like Google profile came up. And I was like, wait a minute, this is like a person that people actually know. And so I was like, okay, well, I better, you know, better listen to an episode of his podcast. I better, you know, prepare to talk about my research. And then as soon as I come over, you greet me with a big hug, and all you want to do is talk about bad MMA.
Of course.
And
my favorite topic.
Right, exactly, yes. Exactly. But and so, you know, since that point, you know, little by little, I became Savannah's head coach for her MMA career, and she's now actually an instructor at the martial arts academy that I just opened, Modern Martial Arts and Fitness. And yeah, it's just really crazy in hindsight to think that 9 times out of 10 I probably just that whole meeting just probably would have happened.
Right. No, and that's what's funny about life. And that I think is what's both weird, because sometimes like I feel the same thing you do, like where there are so many people you run into, so many opportunities, so many things, and on the surface everything look like, sure, I could do that. Mm-hmm. But you have limited time and energy. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bunch of stuff that you're going to say, yeah, I can do everything in theory, but I don't have the time and energy for everything. So at some point, I'll have to make a call and say yes to some stuff and no to others. And the funny thing about it is that most of the time, you don't know where that can lead. And so I think that's why sometimes there's the tendency to overextend. Like I do it online a lot. Like I have conversation with 3 gazillion people. And realistically, at some point, it's like, there's diminishing returns once in a while where it's like, look, you don't have time already, just stop. But then you do have these things happen when you run into people that you would have never in a million years imagined, and something click and you look at it 3 years down the road and you're like, holy shit, look at all the things that happen because of this one chance meeting. So it's the universe is an interesting place in that way.
Yeah, that's for and sure. this is definitely a very good example of that. And I want to be clear, this is not, you know, when I say I'm not that social and stuff, this is certainly not a thing where, you know, I don't like meeting people or you know, the people in my life I don't want to spend time around. It's not anything like that. I just think I'm not always that fun, to be honest. You know, I don't drink. I don't really go to different events and stuff. And so I just feel like sometimes out of place at some of those things. And, you know, I think most people probably can't tell. I think I do, you know, I can kind of zealot my way through situations like that. But yeah, I'm really glad I showed up.
I tend to do much better one-on-one than I do in like a party scenario. Like I don't dig that. It's like, to me, it's too noisy. Conversation doesn't flow because you are distracted with a bunch of shit. There's all this stuff up. It's like, I enjoy more when it's a few people and, you know, then you can have a real conversation and that's engaged. Or you're doing something. And then again, there's a way to, you're reading somebody else. You're getting clues from them. It's a dance, you know?
Right.
Whereas in big chaotic situation, I'm like, I don't care. I have your attitude. Like, I'll stay home with a book and I'm 10 times happier and screw it all, you know? It's like, so yeah, but because of that, one thing leading to another, I ended up in Malaysia at eating at 7-Eleven, which is one of your passions, as we have established, getting mugged by crazy monkeys at a temple, getting being in the corner at one championship. So yeah, that's sound like pretty fun stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I'm very, very thankful that things turned out the way they did. That's for sure.
That's awesome. So let's start a little bit with your academic side. You are finishing right now. How long do you have left for your PhD?
So I've completed my coursework. Next year is going to be pretty busy. I have to take what they call a qualifying exam, and I have to publish a paper, and then I have to write and defend my dissertation prospectus. The prospectus I'm not too concerned with, given that I've already been conducting research for the dissertation, but it's certainly going to be a time-consuming thing like everything else. So next year will be really busy, and that'll be my fourth year. But after that year, I'll be, you know, ABD or all but dissertation. And at that point, I can just continue working on the dissertation, and it'll probably take me... So a conservative estimate, I think, probably 3 years from now I should be done. It would I would like to be done in two, but given that I'm now running a business we'll see.
Yeah, that's the classic career trajectory that everybody does. You know, you have you own, operate, and teach an MMA school, and you are getting a PhD in sociology. What, you know?
Like I said, everyone in my department, we're all doing the same thing.
Yeah, of course. Who doesn't do that? Like, I literally don't think there's a single person in US today who's doing both things at the same time. I would be very impressed if somebody's owning and teaching at a jiu-jitsu MMA school and getting a PhD in sociology. That would be...
You know, it's funny that you put that you specified anyone in the U.S. because one example that does come to mind outside of the U.S. is Lachlan Giles.
Okay,
actually
okay.
Has a PhD, runs an academy, and certainly has one on me is that he's also an active elite competitor in jiu-jitsu. So,
right.
You know, I've still got a ways to go.
That's pretty funny. But I guess why sociology and why specifically? You know, you pick something sort of niche with women in combat sports, specifically MMA, but in combat sports. What drew you to both of those things, sociology in general and women in combat sports in particular?
Yeah, so with sociology, when I was young, I enrolled in a community college.
When I was young, because
when I was younger, anyway,
gray and hunched over, and I see, yes, yeah,
I do now actively have to cut out gray hairs from my beard. So
I'll check that out.
You know, I think I'm earning my stripes in terms of
I see
oldness, but yeah. So I was enrolled at the community college near my parents' house, which was College of Lake County. And I was pretty much enrolled solely because my parents told me I had to. I really had no interest in school. Mm-hmm. I didn't do particularly well in high school. I certainly didn't have an interest in continuing my education. But I think I did at least feel the pressure most young people feel that you should go to college. Mm-hmm. Even though I was a first-generation college student, I definitely grew up in a household that encouraged that path. And so, you know, I enrolled basically, I used a strategy that I honestly would recommend for any, you know, any young person starting college who doesn't know what they want to do. I basically took intro to everything.
Yeah.
Intro to psychology, intro to sociology, intro to philosophy, you know, and it was my intro to sociology class that really stuck. And, you know, when I first entered the class, I had no interest in sociology whatsoever. I certainly couldn't have told you what sociology was. The closest thing I had to a sociology class in high school was a social problems class, mm-hmm. which was one of my least favorite classes I had ever taken.
Right.
And so I think if I had been more aware that social problems was part of sociology, I might not have enrolled at all.
Right.
But fortunately, I didn't know. And the first week of class, truth be told, I actually didn't show up. I actually did show up on the very first day. I grabbed a syllabus. I sat there waiting for class to begin. And for whatever reason, I got a bad sense about the class and I actually left. And I thought, I'll enroll in something else. And then I didn't enroll in anything else because I was irresponsible. And so when week two rolled around, I thought, well, I should probably show up to that class.
Yeah, I need to go back.
They tend to, you know, frown on not attending.
They do.
And so so I came in the next week, and I'm watching my instructor teach this class. And I'm like, to my amazement, it was like, you know, instantly like one of the best classes I've ever taken. Mm. It just actually was captivating. It was, you know, he was making us all laugh and stuff. And I think that was probably the first time in college that, you know, sitting in a classroom, I actually kind of forgot about the fact that I was in school. You know, like I was just really just enjoying myself. And so I, you know, I obviously attended class regularly after that and applied myself. And it was a really, really wonderful experience. And so the last day of class, I actually went up to my instructor and thanked him for class, and I told him, I think I want your job. And he, you know, laughed and was like, oh, you do, huh? And I was like, yeah, I really think I do. And I was like, so, you know, what do? Do I major in education?
Right.
You know, and he was like, well, no, you'd have to major in sociology if you want to teach sociology. But, you know, that, you know, gives you some insight into how little I knew about it. But something about it just really spoke to me, you know.
Well, and I think connected with what you were saying earlier about our meeting, there's the chance element of it all is so bizarre, because when you think about it, you know, you took intro to this, intro to that, intro to the other one. You take intro to sociology and are, or any class, and you're flipping a coin, because realistically you could have some crappy professor who doesn't want to be there, you get a bad vibe. Of course, at that point, the material could be the most interesting thing on earth and automatically filter through this person and become like, yeah, I don't want to deal with that crap, and your whole career trajectory changes. Not only you don't want to do that for a living, but you don't even care for that one class that one time. So it's like, zoop, you drew an X and there's nothing left to it. So yeah, the chance element of it all is pretty interesting how that works out, because yeah, one different teacher would have made your whole experience would have changed. You would have picked something else. And then the thing that you did that makes perfect sense is when you do find something that you like, exactly what you did is you talk to that person.
Right.
It's like, how did you get to be where you are? Because I kind of like your life. I like your, you know, where, get a sense of what that entails from the inside, not from the outside. And then it's, okay, how do I go from where I'm at now to where you are? What's the path?
Right.
And most people are totally happy to tell you about it. You know, most people have no problems giving you tips about this is what I've done, this is what you should have avoided, this. And it makes life so much easier. So for, it doesn't have to be in academia, it can be in any field in the world. If you start getting a feeling that there are certain things that maybe, just maybe, could be interesting for your life, talk to the people in that business. Understand this, if the image from the outside mirrors your priorities, like how much free time you have, how much time you have to put into it, how, what steps do you need to take to get there? Are those steps worth it for you? And all of it. And then you can actually make an educated choice at that point, which is exactly what you did with this.
Absolutely. And so, and I should say, by the way, this is Professor John Tenuto at College of Lake County, who, you know, is just an absolutely wonderful instructor. I'm sure I'm just one of many students who had such, you know, a profound impact on. And what spoke to me most sitting in that classroom is that, you know, my parents, you know, from a young age, I watched my dad get up, you know, 5 or 6 a.m. every morning, you know, drive an hour to Chicago and go work all day. And, you know, I would just see that every day and think to myself, no way.
Hell no.
You know, that's
right.
Just, that's not for me, you know. And so the idea of having like a real job was just, you know, terrifying to me. And so then to see this person up there who, you know, certainly being a professor qualifies as a real job, and to watch him up there and just, it was so transparent that he was really enjoying himself.
Yeah.
You know, he was putting a lot of his personality into it. And he really made the class his own. And, you know, I was a performer myself. I was also a musician. And watching him up there, what he was doing is he was performing.
Yeah,
and
of course.
You know, so that part of it very much spoke to me. And I thought to myself, well, I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, like I could go up there and talk to college kids and make the class, you know, about things I like talking about and make them laugh and have fun with it. And so that, you know, it really, really was a profound moment in my life. And I very much try to do that for young people now. And so one of the opportunities I have as a graduate student is that I also have the opportunity to teach classes and work with, especially working at UC Riverside. You know, a lot of the students in my classes are, you know, they didn't come from like a life of privilege and stuff. And for a lot of them, they don't know why they're there yet.
Yep.
And to, you know, for them to have, you know, a relatively young person in the front of the room who they can somewhat relate to and say, well, you know, this person, you know, maybe challenges their assumptions about what academia is and what a life like that could be when they see me with, you know, in my cauliflower ears and, you know, I'm talking about MMA and stuff. And it's a moment where they go, well, wait a minute, maybe this isn't what I thought this was. And so I really see it as my obligation now to try to provide that example for them. And I, you know, I end every one of my quarters by talking about grad school or talking about the process to get into grad school. And I always encourage them to see me after, you know, even after they're done being a student in my class and stuff. And I thankfully do have a lot of students who come back later and email me, you know, is it okay if I stop by your office? I just want to talk to you about my other classes or whatever. And it's really great to be able to pay that back a little bit now.
No, that's awesome. And I think that's where, that's the fun of it, because, you know, you're doing something that turn an experience, which realistically most people are bored out of their mind in most classes. So it turns what could be a punishing experience into a fun one for them, and vice versa. And that's typically part of my day one speech in any class I teach, is like, let's look at this. Somebody put money in my bank account every month for me to show up here and talk about stuff I like. I mean, come on. Is that even a job?
Right.
That's a joke, right? It's like, so I feel that I owe something to somebody, which in this case is you guys, because you're taking the class, making it possible for me to get paid for this. So the least I can do is to try to make it fun for you. And again, it goes two ways. It's fun for you because I'm a selfish bastard and I want it to be fun for me. Because, you know, if you guys are all bored out of your mind, I'm not going to be having great fun. And vice versa, it's a two-way street, you know. It's like, and so I think teaching in that regard is, it's really, I'm always amazed at how many people are terrible at teaching.
Right.
Because it's just like, look, it's not that hard. If you're passionate about something and you're excited about something and obviously you have enough knowledge because you spend so much time studying it, how hard it is. Your passion is going to shine through. Your knowledge, of course, you do that all the time, so you should know your stuff. How hard is that? Except that then I take a peek in the next classroom and I'm like, oh, it turns out it's a lot harder than I thought.
Yep.
Because it's funny, though. I don't get it. Because, I mean, there are times when, like, I have been a shitty teaching day and I'm like, man, this was boring. And then people are like, no, what are you talking about? It's fun. And I'm like, no, it's not. And then I look at the other class. I'm like, oh, because the bar is set that low. Okay.
Right.
Yes, I can do better than that one on my worst day. That's fine. Uh-huh. But that's not saying much. It's weird. It's strange how it is. But good for, you know, in that case, when you are passionate, that's half of the story. That's half of the game, is having that passion for the subject and teaching itself and the interaction with the students. And for whatever reason, a lot of people don't have it, which is then what kind of kills the whole experience. But in any case, other than my bitching about the teaching quality of the average MMA, because, I mean, that's, okay, that's part of the paradox of who you are to begin with. You know, you are, like, if somebody... If we get a visual of who you are minus the years, everybody would say, oh, sweet, mellow guy, very intellectual, properly dressed, all nice. You get a more of a, if we're going to with the stereotype, the nerdier stereotype. And then, you know, it's like, wait, why did I attach Randy Couture's ears to this guy who's all like studying PhDs? What's going on here, you know? And you have this like, I mean, it's like anybody who knows anything about grappling take a look at you and goes like, holy shit, that guy has grappled a lot. It's like, there's... So that's part of what's not the most common thing in the world, to be this so deep into academics, to get your PhD, to write your dissertation, you're going to be teaching, all of that. And also to have such a heavy, not like an amateurish thing, like such a heavy, intense exposure to combat world and passion for it. How do people in the combat world scenario, like, people from MMA, and how do people in academia respond to the fact that clearly you don't neatly fit in either one of those boxes? Because you can do, you have all of their stuff plus a whole side to you, and vice versa. And so it's like, what's the response in academia, and what's the response among martial arts guys?
That's an interesting question. I've never really sat down and thought about that in that way.
Do you get strange looks, or kind of like...
You know, in academia, to be honest, I rarely do. And maybe that's because I also kind of dress the part and stuff, like you said. So I think in academia, I'm around people who are such nerds sometimes that I don't think they even associate my ears with any sort of combat sport.
Oh, they have no idea about
anything.
So
if anything, they're just like, oh, maybe he has some sort of deformity that I should bring up.
So right, they just have no idea.
Because now that I think about it, academia is probably the arena in which people mention my ears the least.
Right.
You know, like I'll be getting gas somewhere and someone will, you know, strike up a conversation.
Right. Hey, oh, you'll fight. You know, of course.
Wrestle, yeah, yeah. Like that. But at the university, you know, other than, you know, some students sometimes, whatever, I can only think of one professor actually who's ever asked, and it turned out he had wrestled and stuff. But so I think for academics, they probably just don't even know why
it's
my ears look that way. There.
But what about your research topic? When you say, do you know what I really want to do for my PhD in sociology? Uh-huh. I want to study women in combat sports. Uh-huh. Did people respond like, the hell are you talking about? Or what was the...
No, not really. So so my, you know... first and foremost, I would say I consider myself a sociologist of sport, which is, you know, very much at least a mildly respected thing.
Right.
It's at least a thing.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I would consider my primary specialization in sociology to be gender studies.
Right.
And so I
can hear Jordan Peterson somewhere having a heart attack going like, sociology, gender studies, you bust. Neo-Marxist, postmodern piece of crap.
You're probably right, but so to me it was probably somewhat obvious that I would do some sort of project related to gender. But in terms of sport, it was really someone when I was I did an undergraduate program and a master's program at DePaul University after studying at CLC, and I was proposing a research project to a professor at one point. It was some gender-related project, sort of a classical gender studies project. And he was like, yeah, that sounds okay. He was like, didn't you say that you fought in a cage at one point? Why don't you study that? You know, there are enough people doing gender
That's
studies.
Awesome.
Why don't you do that? Because other sociologists aren't going to be
of
able
course.
To analyze that through the lens that you would. And I was like, that's a thing? I could do that? And
cool.
He was like, yes, of course you could. And then he, you know, showed me some other martial arts studies and stuff in sociology. And if it had not been for that, you know, back to these, you know, this...
random...
Right, yeah. Right. These chances, these life chances. If it had not been for that, I don't know that I would have ever, you know, found my way into a project like that. And so... For my work now, to me, it's right at that intersection of my interest in gender, mm-hmm. my interest in sport, in particular combat sports. And certainly as a martial artist and a combat sports athlete, I was always aware of sort of the gender dynamics in the academy and stuff. And it always appealed to me as an interesting arena in which we can analyze, you know, the constructions of, you know, masculine and feminine identities and all sorts of things related to gender. And in particular, I was always drawn to this. It's funny. It's ironic that you had said that I sort of live a bit of a paradox, mm-hmm. because what always intrigued me is sort of the paradoxical nature of these women combat sports athletes who both, you know, exist as combat sports athletes, but also women in society.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's what, you know, scholars have actually labeled this, the female athlete paradox. And so what I'm seeing my current work as is basically sort of a magnified version of that, particularly with combat sports. You know, the things that these women athletes have to deal with in more conventional sports are just, you know, they deal with them to a much greater extent, I would say, in combat sports.
Yeah, like I've talked to you before, so I know what you're talking about. But for people who are not catching on, in which way? Like, what's the paradox mm-hmm. there?
Yeah, so, you know, in combat sports, you know, these women certainly have to train their bodies for violence, right? Mm-hmm. So they, you know, so they develop musculature that's maybe not as common for other women.
Mm-hmm.
They spend their life, you know, sweating in a gym with other men, and you know, they're not often able to keep longer nails. You know, sort of these sort of stereotypical, you know, feminine things that, you know, that we associate with women sometimes. That women are otherwise in Western society encouraged to partake in. They're not able to do so in this particular arena, and so many of the things that they do have to participate in or are encouraged to do, we would traditionally define as masculine endeavors.
Yeah.
but which may suggest that, you know, this is like a, this may suggest that for these particular women, that they, you know, are more drawn to masculine activities and such. But for many of them, that's not the case. For many of them, their participation in MMA is somewhat unique to the rest of their lives, where in the rest of their lives, you know, they do enjoy participating in activities that we would more stereotypically associate as feminine activities. And so for them, what results is this paradox where, you know, they have these sort of opposing interests, and how they reconcile this paradox is of particular interest to me.
And I think that's why, in general, this theme that we're playing with, the very idea of paradox, is fun. You know, paradox to me is at the essence. I think it's like one book that I wrote in Create Your Own Religion, I believe it was the last chapter, is all about paradox, because to me that's what Taoism is. That's what the essence of life is. It's about this mix of opposites, which traditionally, you know, traditional wisdom would say black and white, very different. One thing belongs to this, one thing belongs to that. And instead, when those two seemingly opposite, but not really opposite, intertwine, it's where life gets fun. It's where it's interesting.
Absolutely.
That's why you win academia while doing MMA, while these ladies doing something that's traditionally considered masculine, without having to turn into the stereotype of what the ultra-masculine woman is. All of that is fascinating, because you're essentially inventing a path where there's not necessarily, especially, you know, when you think about women in MMA, there was no MMA 25, 30 years ago, and there definitely was no women MMA until much more recently.
Right.
So these, a lot of people are really just kind of making it up as they go, because there aren't really too many established role models for it, of what it means to be. We're talking with Savannah, we went to see this documentary about Cambodia, martial arts in Cambodia, and there was a lady there. So, do you know how do you pronounce her name?
Tara.
Yes, that. Thank you. It's like, okay, yeah, I don't even bother trying to pronounce the Cambodian name, but it's super sweet woman, delightful to be around. And one of the first things that she said with Savannah was like, yeah, it's... they don't, like, she works as an actress in Cambodia, and she says it's really hard to get parts sometimes because they say that my muscles are too big. And I was like, and by the way, you see her and she's about half the size of Savannah. So it's like, my muscles are too big was like, oh my God, that's what they, and you know, she's muscular, she's strong, but she's little. And it was very interesting. And so it was like, and you see her and there's nothing, like, she's very feminine in plenty of ways. She has that side, but it's like, hey, just because I have that side doesn't mean I have to give up this other side. Enjoy both. What's wrong with wanting both? Which is basically what the question that all good paradoxes pose. It's like, I enjoy this, but I also enjoy this other thing that all the people who enjoy A don't enjoy B. But I do. So here we are.
Yep.
In your research, one thing that when we are chatting, not on the mic, about that I was gathering from it, is that some of the conclusions that you were beginning to reach based on your research were sometimes rather surprising, that like some of these ladies who are involved in a sport where traditionally few women have gone into, are involved in terms of values and things, in things that have seen, been seen as very masculine, in many cases they are, they very much subscribe to a more traditional gender roles approach to seeing, despite the fact that they are clearly violating it in some aspects of their life by mixing and entering a world that's traditionally been very male dominated. But at the same time, some of their values don't really reflect that. And so it's a weird paradox of this female empowerment. I want to be free to do what I want. I want to be able to do the things that men do, and great and good for you. While at the same time, having an element where, I don't know, like, you know this whole thing better than I do. So if you want to jump into it.
Yeah, so one thing I would change about what you said is, you said in spite of the fact that you know, they're combat sports athletes. I would say in light of the fact that they're combat sports athletes, they find themselves sort of overscribing to these, you know, traditional notions of gender and such. And so there's sort of a trope in women's mixed martial arts that, you know, every woman fighter, you know, dates either her trainer or, you know, another combat sports athlete. And with my particular research, I've very much found that to be the case. And so I would ask these women, you know, why? Like, why are you all only dating other fighters, basically? And at first, you know, some of the answers I would get were, well, you know, they understand the lifestyle and, you know, and, you know, et cetera. And so I would ask, okay, well, why is that important for you? But why does that not seem to be important for these male athletes who, you know, their wives and girlfriends do not partake in the sport? And if anything, these men seem to enjoy that fact. You know, why is it so important that they understand this? Or and over time, the answers started to change. And what I ultimately found was the most common answer was basically, you know, their ability to accomplish femininity was somewhat contingent upon their partner. And so, you know, masculinity and femininity are relative concepts. You know, we define them in opposition to, to the other. And so for these women who, you know, in most aspects of their lives, you know, they occupy a somewhat dominant role. You know, they would often describe this to me in conversations of, you know, they would, you know, reference alpha and beta and such. And they would say things like, you know, well, I'm an alpha, so I need someone who's more alpha than me. Which, you know, they would say it as if this were obvious. You know, and I would be like, okay, well, that still doesn't make sense yet. You know, like, why?
Yeah.
Like, why do you need someone that's more than more of an alpha for you than you? And what I basically found, you know, like I was saying, is for them, their ability to feel feminine was contingent upon them, you know, having a partner who was more masculine than them. And the way that they would define masculinity was very traditional, very narrow.
Me crush and, skulls.
Exactly.
Me have big muscles.
Exactly. Yeah, in which, you know, I think speaks to the arena in which they spend their time. And so, you know, for these women, you know, in most aspects of their life, you know, they might feel masculine or feel strong, feel powerful. But if, you know, they find, you know, an intimate partner who is this hyper-masculine male, relative to them, they feel dainty. They feel vulnerable.
And they want to feel
and
that way.
And they want to feel these things. And this is, you know, from a sociological standpoint, my argument is not that, you know, these are inherent needs or wants. These are things they've been conditioned to want. They've been told their entire lives, you're supposed to be small. You're supposed to be feminine. You're supposed to be soft. And for these women who they're sort of unable to feel this, well, if they get the right partner, relative to that partner,
they can feel these things. If you are with Mike Tyson, you can be the toughest one in the world. You still are going to be... that's bizarre. In a few ways. It's bizarre to me because, I mean, I don't mean to cast judgment on it because everybody's business is their business, but it seems to me that it still comes from a bit of a place of insecurity. Because, and again, I'm just going to throw it out there and I don't expect anyone to agree or I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. But to me, it seems like if you are 100% comfortable in your own skin, you don't even need that kind of definition. You know, you don't need to be, it's like your femininity, your sense of, or even like the need to define so strongly what makes you masculine, what makes you feminine, the fact that you are, why do you feel this need to throw it out there? Why, you know, it's like to me, if you are sweet, oh, sweet is seen as feminine, or but you're also strong. Why do you feel the need to kind of dissect it to decide, oh, I'm strong, but hey, look, I'm also this side, so that means I am a bad... It's like, it's who you are, right? It's like, to me, if I don't get... Like, to me, I can imagine. I cannot see it, and you're correct in that regard, which is very hard because you don't see it in reality very often. But I'm intrigued with the idea of an absolutely badass woman who may choose to have a relationship with a guy who's not at all matching her passion for the same thing. Maybe he's a sweet guy who mm-hmm. meditates and study Buddhism or what the fuck. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like something where that doesn't make him a bad person. He just doesn't want, if anything, he can be a delightful human being. He just doesn't have to go into that same field where she may have a side that's more aggressive, if you want, or mm-hmm. tougher or more conflict driven than he is. And so what? Mm-hmm. What's the big deal? You know? Now, I'm saying it. I'm not a woman. A. Mm-hmm. I don't feel the same pressure that women are exposed to every single day of their life. So again, I'm not casting it as a judgment, like, right. Oh, somebody's wrong to feel otherwise. I'm just purely speaking it from my viewpoint without yeah. absolutely trying to say it in any other way. But I find that interesting because yeah. it's, I've seen that, like I've seen interviews and things where you get that theme coming up a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. you obviously have gone much deeper than anyone else on this topic, but you do see it and it makes you wonder, is like, why do you have that need? You know, what is mm-hmm. it about it that you need to, you know, you're challenging the traditional gender norms all the time anyway. Mm-hmm. Why can't you live with the fact that you are you, which is this weird mix of multiple things at the same time? And if somebody's trying to categorize you as masculine or feminine or mm-hmm. whatever, that's just their problem because you are you, you know?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. I would say first and foremost, it's probably more difficult for you and I to understand this.
Sure.
Because, you know, you and I are privileged in the fact that we have greater freedom to be whoever we want and we don't really get sanctioned for these things, yeah. you know? You know, unlike, for instance, the athlete that Savannah had the pleasure of meeting, who is constantly reminded that she's transgressing, that she's doing something wrong.
Sure.
That her muscles are not only big, they're too big.
Mm-hmm.
That she's not only a little bit masculine, she's too masculine. And over time, I can only imagine that this becomes quite uncomfortable.
I would add slightly twist to what you're saying, because I think you're 100% correct, right? The kind of pressure that women will feel to fit into certain norms are obviously the kind of pressure that are very hard for men to understand, and in some cases vice versa. So I get that. I do think, though, that everyone, to some degree or another, experience, not the same, but some pressures, because the very nature of being a bit paradoxical, the very nature of putting together things that don't normally go together, mm-hmm. will mean, and that's why I was asking you earlier if you got any kind of, because to me, in my experience, you do get that if you are in one particular world and you tell them, yes, I can speak your language, but I also do this, and the other,
uh-huh.
there is that, but why? That's right. not what one of us, in our tribe, we don't do this.
Right.
What's your deal? And vice versa, if you're in this other universe and you speak this language that they don't speak. So to me, it's like everybody deals with it to one degree or another.
Sure.
I think what you're saying is in the case of something as essential as gender norms in most society, that may go deeper. And
yes.
in the case of women, again, that may go even deeper because right. of the expectations that are put on them. But yeah, it's trippy how that works. And
absolutely.
It's trippy how, you know, people who are so, such strong individuals, and yet you see the layers in which culture has been working on the inside of them so deep that in many cases some of these norms are internalized.
Absolutely.
To a degree they don't even realize.
Absolutely. And to that point, I would say, exactly to that point, I would also add that you and I probably do this more than either one of us, you know, is even aware of, you know. So using myself as an example, I'm not, you know, particularly tall for a man. I'm 5'8" on a better day, let's say. And so, but my wife is 5'1". Now, did I put out an ad and say, you know, only interested in women under 5'2"?
Right.
No. And, you know, I, you know, love my wife and, you know, been with her for 10 years now. And so obviously we have something in common, but, you know, would I have, you know, initially had that attraction or sought her out if she were 6 feet tall? Maybe, but I didn't, you know, she
sure.
isn't.
Of course.
Know? And so, you know, and so this, like specifically with height, for instance, this is what scholars call the male taller norm, which basically demonstrates that, you know, men do tend to be taller than women, but not to the extent in which men are taller than women in, you know, heterosexual sure. couples. You know, this is what they call assortive mating, where, you know, men and women both actively seek relationships wherein the man is taller than the woman. And so, you know, it's not something, it's something that we internalize so strongly that we're often not even aware that it sure. that it's happening.
No, I think it's like, I'm 100% confident that that's true for everyone else. Of course not for me,
of
because
course
I
not,
have a full and total awareness of every single possible
no
bias that
may,
of course. You know, on this thing about the so-called masculine, so-called feminine qualities and all of that topic, which I always find fascinating because I'm of the, you know, good old-fashioned Taoism. I have come from that school of thought that there are certain qualities that are desirable for all human beings. Mm-hmm. So to me, the traditional gender stereotypes, which unfortunately are very true in plenty of cases, mm-hmm. of what the typical woman is supposed to be like, the typical man is supposed to be like, I can't stand either. You
right.
know what I mean? The typical manly man, I'm like, Jesus Christ, I read
yeah.
a book once in a while. The typical feminine woman, I want to shoot myself. You know, I just like, I find, because to me it's like anyone who's worth a damn should want to be able to be in touch with their feelings,
mm-hmm.
traditionally feminine thing, and be able to read somebody else's emotion and relate on an emotional level. Anyone who's worth a damn should develop strength and resilience and toughness and willpower, traditionally masculine thing. It's like, to me, those things are just like, those are human things that any, you know, life is made of all of those elements, and anybody who wants to have a meaningful life should develop all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're gonna develop some more than others, in tune with your nature, in tune with whatever. But as far as having at least a baseline in all of them, I find it weird, the notion that we encourage people to just go become more extreme in what they are already strong at, and vice versa. And kind of overlook some of the stuff that may, which I guess tied in an odd kind of way to martial arts. This is a discussion that I've had with a few people, and I'm curious of what your take is on it. There are a few martial arts instructors that I've been friends with who always tell me they get more out of teaching the small nerdy guy, the mom of three kids, the people who are not typical martial arts people, than they do by just teaching a team of killers to be like the greatest fighters in the world. And they say, not that that's not fun, that's fun too, but they get more out of adding to somebody's life qualities that I would not be there otherwise.
Yes.
And that martial art practice, it can do a lot of that for people who are a little more shy, who are adverse to conflict, who are more introspective, and all of that. It can add this edge that otherwise is hard to develop.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on it? What's your, like, as far as teaching, what the kind of people you enjoy teaching, the kind of classes you run, what's your particular feel for it all?
So first and foremost, I always feel, you know, privileged to be able to share martial arts with anyone. It's something that I feel very passionate about. It's very, very important to me. But I certainly would agree. I get the most fulfillment out of introducing people to martial
mm-hmm.
arts. You know, in seeing them, you know, become in tune with their own bodies, seeing them, you know, develop, you know, courage or just comfort in,
mm-hmm.
in being uncomfortable, you know, all the things that, you know, we often recite in martial arts and such. To me, martial arts has just done so much for me, you know, outside of, you know, combat sports competition
mm-hmm.
and stuff. You know, so like a question I'll often get asked by especially new students is like, have you ever had to use, let's say, jiu-jitsu, you know in real life or
sure.
whatever? And my answer is always simple: yes, every day I use it. You know, I use it in my studies, I use it in my conversations with my wife, I use it any time where a situation calls for me to be calm,
mm-hmm.
And to, you know, systematically think through problems under duress.
Well, I'm glad you explained that, because I was just picturing you choking out unconscious some random graduate student
uh-huh.
at your uni. I'm glad we yeah. explained that. That's good.
But,
you know, I get jiu-jitsu in conversation with my wife, uh-huh. and she pissed me off and I armbar her. And yes,
I'm glad I clarified
yes.
that, because I wasn't thinking about that when I was saying it. But, But I very much have found that to be the case in my own life, where, yeah, you know, the lessons that I've learned through martial arts, you know, have been more, more beneficial to me outside of, yeah, you know, traditional martial arts arenas. And so knowing that and having that insight, I get particular enjoyment out of introducing people to martial arts, knowing wholeheartedly that it will do the same for them, you know, to a lesser or greater extent, but to some extent it will do that. And, mm-hmm, and when I see that happen for someone, when I see that transformation happen, it's just, there's no greater feeling.
And that's one thing that I think is awesome about what you do and your approach to martial arts, that a lot of these more philosophical, idealistic, la-la, make the world a better place, personal growth, that kind of talk, mm-hmm, is great often among people who are terrible at fighting, you know, or people who approach martial arts in a purely philosophical way. And then you see what they do, and it's sweet. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. I'm glad it exists. But when it comes to effectiveness, it's like, yeah, not quite, mm-hmm, you know. And so I find it refreshing when instead is somebody who you can play the game of just being, I'm just going to be the most badass in the room, but okay, now that I know it, so what? I don't need to go there. I'm going to choose to go in the more philosophical, happy, make life better type of approach, uh-huh, where that kind of thing is a choice rather than, well, you need to be nice because that's all you got going for you, you know. And that's also what's funny about the experience of, you know, if any of you guys ever get to visit Justin's school, get to learn from him or get to roll with him, that's one of the things that's funny, that, you know, you obviously have a very clear intellectual understanding of the game, which is why you make a great coach. But then the way you perform it is like, holy shit, that's a different level of the game. Like, I remember, like, first time where I rolled with you, I was like, oh, damn, this is a different game. Because, you know, it's like, I'm not, you know, the greatest grappler out there, but I can do decent. And especially with people who are way less than me. I mean, that's rare enough that when somebody way less than me, it's very unlikely that I'm going to have too much trouble. And then I roll with you, and clearly, you know, there are times when I roll with somebody who's, you know, very experienced, and I'm like, yeah, okay, you're getting me, but you're also 45 pounds heavier than me. It's like, some of it is technique, sure, for sure, but how much, right? In your case, there's none of that question, right? Because when I roll, it's like, I'm the heavier guy. Mm-hmm. And then I see the way your technique flows, and I'm like, oh, damn, he can do anything he wants, anytime he wants. And so I'm like, oh, that's just straight up techniques. That just be the killer purely on skill, not because he's like, oh, I'm going to crush you through extra weight. So it's funny because then anybody, you know, especially because your demeanor is so much more mellow, so much more, you know, well-spoken than the typical MMA person. So it would be easy for the guy who has tattoos on his necks and head and stuff to go like, ha, Justin, screw that guy, look at him. So, but then they have to roll. That's the beauty of martial arts. And then you get to see what happens. And then you go like, oh, okay, that's a different. So that's, to me, is the beauty of the paradox. Is like, you can, through your actual skill on the mat, you earn the right to say things that somebody else can say the same thing. And is like, yeah, that's a pretty speech, but can you say it? Because that's, can you look past the achievements because you have none, that's why, or can you look past the achievements because you have all of them and you're taking it further? And so once you get somebody to choke you out enough time in a row, suddenly their words carry more meaning, uh-huh, you know. They can say the same thing that somebody else has said, but it's like, oh, this has a different layer of depth to it. And I feel that you are perfect for that because you don't fit the mold of the, you know, the stereotype of what people have in mind when they think MMA. And yet, results speak for themselves. So it's...
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And man, you just identified what's like arguably my main motivation as a martial artist. I'll explain. As much as I love the world of martial arts, and martial arts has done so much for me, there are a lot of things about the way that we practice martial arts and share martial arts that I very much want to see changed. And as you identified, it's one thing for an outsider or someone who's just you know, not that skilled in martial arts to say, oh, I don't like this, we should change this. And everyone says, well, who are you?
Right.
It's another thing when it comes from someone who, you know, you have at least, you know, a little bit of respect for.
Yep.
And that person says, oh, no, I'm good at this, and I still don't think it's the right way to do it.
Yep.
You know, and so, you know, I think I kind of, and it's, and this might, you know, tie in what seem like, you know, opposing, you know, fields in martial arts and sociology, where my motivation is the same in academia.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a student, I would just sit in class after class and think to myself, surely there has to be a better way to do this.
Yep.
But I don't have the right to say that. Whereas, you know, now as a PhD student, I do have the right to say
sure.
that, you know, and to say, hey, you know, these are problems of pedagogy that
yeah.
need to be changed. And, you know, here are data that support this idea.
Right.
And I see it as the same in martial arts where, you know, I say, nope, I trained exactly how you trained. And my coaches were exactly how you're saying that this should be. And he, you know, and I was able to, you know, I have relatively modest accomplishments in martial arts. I've won, you know, small tournaments and stuff. And, but, you know, I was able to get there in many respects, you know, by forging my own path,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, to be able to now challenge some of these things and say, well, you know, I have been, you know, also trained traditionally and, you know, have trained with some of the best instructors in the world. And as a very experienced martial artist, I'm saying we need to change some of
yep.
these things.
Yep.
And so that's a great source of motivation for me to continue to hone my craft and get better and to be able to beat others at their own game, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to then emphasize my point that some of these things do need to change and for that message to be from someone who, you know, who is in a place that others respect.
What do you want for your school? I mean, you guys just opened.
Mm-hmm.
So actually for people listening, I mean, of course, most of you guys are not in LA, so that doesn't apply. But for people who want to come roll or learn from you and stuff, want to tell them a little bit, just the basics, where you're located, all the good stuff?
Sure. So our academy is called Modern Martial Arts and Fitness. It's in Pasadena, California. You can see the website. It's just modernmartialartsandfitness.com. And everyone is always welcome at all times. And we are trying to do things a little bit different. You know, from the outside looking in, it certainly doesn't look any different. You know,
mm-hmm.
we have a lot of the same classes as other people and stuff. And
right now you're running wrestling,
mm-hmm.
jiu-jitsu, with the gi and without,
mm-hmm.
and Muay Thai, correct?
As well as an actual proper MMA class.
And an MMA class,
yep.
Okay.
And so, you know, what I saw for this academy was that... you know, I can't help but always just compare martial arts to academia because I'm just so invested in both
sure.
worlds that it's hard for me not to even mix them up at times. And so even when we look at like you know, promotions in jiu-jitsu, you know, the belt system,
yeah.
you know, to me it parallels academia so closely in that, you know, even the time it typically takes
mm-hmm.
between belts, let's say roughly 2 years. And so, you know, in that sense, your blue belt is really like your associate's degree and your purple belt is your bachelor's degree. Your brown belt, you've got your master's, and black belt, well, hey, you've got a PhD now.
Right.
And so I'm constantly drawing these comparisons and so in academia, as you know, we have this distinction between what we would call a research university and a teaching university. And so, for instance, my experience at DePaul University in Chicago was very much a teaching university, where a typical class might have, you know, 20 or 30 students. You know, my professors would know me by my first name. I didn't have TAs. I had actual, you know, one-on-one teaching from my actual instructors. Whereas in a research university like UCR, where I am now, for the undergrad experience there, you know, their professors probably have no idea who they are. They're in a classroom full of, let's say, maybe 200 students. You know, really their only one-on-one attention is with a TA. And so it's really more of a sink or swim environment
yep.
where And the reason is because the professors there are primarily not there to teach. They're there to produce research. And so teaching is very much something that comes, you know, as a second priority for them, if that high.
Right.
And so...
I think I told you, and I may have mentioned it on the podcast a couple of times. Once I heard somebody at UCLA telling me, oh, yeah, this is a great job if it wasn't for the teaching part.
Right.
And I was like, oh, my God, the job is the teaching. Right. But in their mind, it was all the research.
Not, exactly. You know? And unfortunately, in martial arts, we have the same problem where, you know, often it's a high-level competitor who opens up an academy. The other instructors are also high-level competitors. And in order to be able to sustain their careers as competitors, well, they teach on the side and the students pay the bills and they're allowed to train. And so what my goal for our academy was to really be a teaching university for mixed martial arts, mm-hmm. particularly for mixed martial arts, where in my experience I've found often people don't teach MMA classes.
Yeah.
They run MMA practices.
Yep.
And those to me are very, very different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so my hope was to have an academy where people can come and really learn the martial arts. And if they want to compete, that's wonderful. I'd love to support them in their competition journeys, and I'll be there to corner them. But that's their choice.
Yep.
And that to me is my number one priority, is that all of our instructors remember at all times that our students' goals are our students' goals, not ours.
Yep.
And so in my own personal experience, when I was, you know, coming up, let's say as a white belt or just, you know, early in, you know, MMA training and stuff, some of my instructors saw what they thought was potential. Okay. And potential was something for them that was very narrowly defined.
Mm-hmm.
You have the potential to be a good athlete in this particular sport. Therefore, that's what you should be doing.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's probably, you know, the main reason why I competed at all, is because I had instructors tell me I should be competing. But I really never had goals associated with competing. Obviously, when I compete, I would like to win.
Sure, of course.
But it's really not what drives me to train martial arts. And so what I have found as an instructor is that students come into martial arts training for all sorts of different reasons. For some of them, it is, in fact, to actually get the skills to be successful combat sports athletes, and that's wonderful. For some people, it's, maybe I'll compete sometime, but for the most part, I'm a hobbyist, and I just want to really learn the sport and mm-hmm. be good at it. For other people, they just want to get in shape.
Yep.
And for plenty of people, they just want a positive outlet in which they can socialize with other adults.
Right.
And for those people, I want to make sure that their needs are met as well.
Yep.
And so, for instance, if, you know, when I'm running my classes, if I see two people and they're drilling a technique and, yeah, they're not drilling all that hard and they're mostly just talking.
Yeah.
But if they look like they're having fun,
right,
then I'm doing my job.
Of course. Good for them, right?
Because
what they are there for is different. You know, if the guy who's going to compete next month is drilling like that, you probably want to say, hey, man, get on with it.
Exactly.
But yeah, of course.
And so it's important to me that I communicate with my students and gain insight into what their goals are. Because if you do tell me my goal is to win, you know, this particular tournament, or I want to fight MMA, especially if you want to fight MMA,
yeah, then
so
there's
dangerous.
A very different way of training.
It's a very, very different way of training. But if you're like, I want to lose weight, and I want to have fun,
mm-hmm.
and I listen to the Joe Rogan podcast, and he talks about jiu-jitsu, and that's why I'm here, then great. Then
of
I'm here to show you a great time. I'm here to help you lose weight, and I'm here to introduce you to a bunch of great people who will hopefully be your new friends.
Which sound quite awesome. Yeah, in fact, I remember when you were saying, okay, you will train Savannah, you were like, yeah, but if I never have another MMA fighter, it's totally cool by me.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like, that's not what I'm looking for. It's like, maybe, sure, I mean, maybe mm-hmm. it's the right person come along and mm-hmm. everything clicks right, but that's not the goal necessarily.
Right.
They are not trying to create a team of, like, it's like mm-hmm. if it's one person that I'm focusing on for that part, great. And the rest, I focus on other things for the teaching, which is interesting because, again, yeah, most places tend to be very one-dimensional. They either do one aspect and it's pure competition at the highest level, or they don't. And it's it's cool that it gives you the options. Cool. So if you guys are in LA, LA area, even better if you are close to Pasadena, but swing by, get to meet them on the mat, and you find out for yourself about some of this stuff. So as far as your future go, you're seeing, you've got your PhD, you'll end up getting teaching gigs somewhere, and you have your academy, you teach there. That's the goal, like, spend a whole lot of time around other human beings, teaching them a whole bunch in different ways. That's what you want
to
do?
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty wonderful life to me.
Not a bad one, right? Yeah. As I dig it. So, no, it's super cool. I like it because it's, and I think a lot of it is, it's funny what you were saying about, I want to be on my couch and leave me the hell alone in some ways, because that all your professional choices are all very much around other people.
Right.
And interacting with other human beings and talking with a whole lot of people and stuff. So I think it's probably a very natural reaction to also say, okay, I do that already X number of hours a day.
Right.
The rest of the time, it better be worth it.
And that's the thing. I love that side of my life as well. It's just important to me that I also have time for myself.
Of course.
Have time for my wife. Have time to do nothing.
Yeah.
And I don't have a lot of time for those things.
Right.
Particularly time to do nothing.
Yeah.
And so when I do get that time, I make sure to enjoy it.
Yeah, man. I'm one of those weirdos who still have Netflix, the disc that they send you at home, not the streaming where they are. That's still a thing. You know what? Actually, I'm going to give Netflix a free publicity, because you know what it is with that stuff? The range of movies you can watch is so much wider than what they have streaming.
Is that right?
Like, there's so much stuff that they don't have available on stream that they do have on disc.
Huh.
So I'm like, hey, what the hell? I don't need to watch it right now. They'll send it in the mail. I'll watch it. But in any case, my point being, at one point, like a few months ago, I got this movie I wanted to watch, and it starts sitting there, and I'm like, okay, as soon as I have 2-3 hours, I'm gonna check it out. And like, little time goes by, I look at where I checked it out, and I'm like, seriously, this thing has been here for 6 months, and I haven't found 2 hours to watch it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, maybe I need to review my priorities here, because this is ridiculous. Come on, it's like, you need to be able also to slow it down a little. And in your case, that's probably going to happen in a while, because right now you're at a really high point of starting is a big word, because starting is, you've already done it for so long to get to this place,
right,
both in martial arts and in academia. But you're essentially, you know, it's where your career is going to take off in both directions. So there is an element of excitement of, oh, this is where the whole game takes it to a whole other level.
Absolutely.
But that's awesome. So Asia. You guys are going to travel again for Fighting in One, and where do you want to go? What places, if you, out of all the geography that One Championship covers, in which corner do you want to be when you are with Sav? Which part of the world do you want to go to?
So, out of all the places, if I could pick one, I want so badly to go to Japan.
Japan,
you know.
Okay.
So,
that's a good one.
I know we're trying to make that happen,
yeah.
And... you know, as you kind of noted before about how I say, like, you know, if Savannah's the only fighter I ever corner, that's great. You know, I'm certainly not actively looking for others and stuff. But anything that gets me to Japan, I'm not going to complain about.
That's not a bad gig. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, you guys got to go to Malaysia. Now, sweet. Yeah, it's a lot better than being in some organization out here where it's like, yay, we get to fight in Kansas City next week. No offense against Kansas City, but you know what I mean. It's like when you're in US, it's not exactly glamorous. Here you got to travel across the world. That's a sweet gig right there.
It's pretty amazing.
I dig it. Cool, man. Well, on that note, I'll make sure to put the link in the episode notes to the gym. And awesome. Thank you so much for the chat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the funky music means one thing. That's the end of another fine episode of the Drunken Taoist Podcast. Another great interview. Well done, guys. Just to get us out of here quickly, I want to really quickly mention off the top our Kiva donations. $128,775 of donations from your fellow listeners, helping folks around the world. Kiva.org. Come on by, get $25 out, give it a try. There's 218 of your fellow listeners that have done an amazing amount of, you know, you loan it, you get it back, you loan it again. And it just keeps growing, and it is, it really is impressive. And I really appreciate everybody who's been involved and invite everybody to come give it a try because it's pretty fun to do. So give it a look, kiva.org. Now for the most important thing, some mauling of folks' names that were kind enough to give us donations to help us keep the lights on here and keep everything going. So I don't know if I can do the Italian version of messing them up, but I can definitely give you a bit of a Tennessee version. So here we go.
Let the pottering begin.
Nicola Tongni, Samuel Rudelli, Jim D'Amico, Matt Shebrett, Gerald Hoffman, Kachun Lay. Here's a good one. This is a great last name, and I'm certain I'm going to get it wrong, but Jesse Rantakangas? Look at that. Jesse Rantakangas, Janie Linema, and Aaron Weisner. So there you go. There's quite a swat at them, and I'm sure I mangled them pretty good for you. Definitely want to give a thanks to our folks, Daisy House, the fantastic band. You can find them at Bandcamp/Daisy House. Buy a single from these guys. They've given us the use of the incredible Drunken Taoist music for a long, long time, and it really is almost like iconic for our show now. And we would love you guys just reach out. Buy a track or two. They're 99 cents a piece, I believe. And just thank them by buying a couple of their fine songs. And a last overview of our sponsors that do such a grand job of keeping us going. Onnit, Grassland Beef, Sure Design T-shirts, Snow Rose Coffee, and the fine folks at NeverTap Gear. That's it, guys. Want to get you out the door quickly, so we'll see you next time with another sponsor. I believe it's a weed doctor of some kind, so that will actually be music to everybody's ears. So give it a shot, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Bye. And so ends another awesome episode of the Drunken Taoist Podcast. Be sure to keep your ears peeled for another mind-expanding episode coming soon. We'll be tweeting you as they come out. You can keep track of Daniele at D Bolelli. That's D-B-O-L-E-L-L-I. And you can find me on Twitter at RichieMon1. RichimOn and the numeral 1. We'll see y'all soon. Woo!
No, you don't.
In questo caso, le provvidenze di Dio.
Duncan showed you the way, huh?
Oh man, isn't that scary to think?
Nice. So don't kill people, do that instead.
This was great. It's fucking awesome.
And I love this conversation.
I have nothing against chicken other than the fact that they are ugly and weird and strange.
We've been having a great hour here. Dun, dun,
dun. I completely got lost. Are we doing the outro or the intro?
We're outro.
Okay, sorry. So let's continue. Did you ever see the movie Tombstone with Val Kilmer and...
Your accent, it just... Whatever that movie is you were trying to tell me about...
Can you translate for me, please?
I believe the word was Tombstone.
Yeah, that one, exactly. Just as I was saying, you know, Tombstone. Now, most everybody thought... Sorry. We'll do a cut on there.
Or not, that was something else.
That's maybe too powerful. What do I have to do? One day the rod shall teach you.
Get back to work.
Funky. Podcasting. It's like radio, but you can cuss.